All right, welcome back into the Original Gangsters podcast. I'm Scott Bernstein, along with my co-host and partner in crime, Jimmy Bucciolato.
Hello.
We call him the Doc because he has a PhD and makes us all look not as smart as him. So we're here, the second episode of our relaunch. We're really excited to be in our new home and our palatial new studios here at thestartupnation.com. And we want to give a shout out to WJR and their brand new Great Voice of the Great Lakes podcast network that we're a part of. And we're just real happy to be here and get all this great support and all this love from the Startup Nation and WJR people. So thank you. And we're going to, you know, for the fans out there, for all the consumers, we're going to be giving you very consistent Original Gangsters podcast content. It's not going to be as random as it was in the past. We're going to try to give you episodes once a week. And we're very excited about the episode we're going to do right now. We're going to talk about the pandemic, the COVID-19 virus, and the criminal justice system, specifically the Bureau of Prisons, and how a lot of felons, both very high-profile felons and lesser-profile felons, are been trying to leverage COVID-19 into compassionate releases. And a lot of them have been successful in getting their sentence reduced or getting out of prison to do their remainder of their time on home confinement. We had a situation that broke here in Detroit in the last week that has been on the national news radar. It's being written about now in all the papers in Washington, New York, and L.A. And that was the release of a pretty infamous drug kingpin from the west side of Detroit, John the Breadman Bass, who ran the Dog Pound drug gang of the 1990s. He was convicted, I believe he was arrested, indicted in 1998, convicted, I believe, in 02 of a double murder count, serving two life sentences without parole. One of those murders was tied to the gangland slaying of his half-brother and Dog Pound co-founder, Pat the Ram Webb. And he had a compassionate release motion in front of U.S. District Court Arthur Tarnow down in the federal building in Detroit. And even though he was serving a double life homicide conviction and was looking at no chance of parole, Arthur Tarnow let him out of prison in late January when the news of him being released hit the media. There was kind of an outcry and an outrage from federal prosecutors. They appealed the decision to let Breadman Bass out, and the appellate court in Cincinnati stayed the proceedings, and John Breadman Bass was picked back up over the weekend and will have to await the decision from the appellate court about whether or not he can go free. If Arthur Tarnow's decision to let him go free stands, he'll have to wait to hear from behind bars. We're very lucky to bring on a very special guest, Anjali Prasad. She is a criminal defense attorney out of Royal Oak. She's been focusing her practice in the last year or so on helping defendants use compassionate release to extricate themselves from prison early based on COVID concerns. And a lot of that stuff is legitimate. I don't necessarily, not to editorialize too quick in this, I'm not sure if I agree with letting the Breadman Bass out, but there are a lot of felons right now that probably deserve to get out. And, you know, Mrs. Prasad is doing everything she can to help her clients. She was a federal prosecutor, a state prosecutor, and then recently has gone into private practice in Royal Oak. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott.
Yeah. So why don't you kind of tell us how you came about kind of trying to focus on this kind of niche of criminal defense in the last year since the pandemic broke out?
Actually, what happened was I'm a federal defense attorney, and I happen to have a handful of clients in federal prison in Morgantown, West Virginia, actually. A lot of my clients are white-collar clients who are convicted in Detroit, and they end up going to Morgantown FCI because it's a low-security facility. And what ended up happening really was COVID broke. And somehow my name got mentioned a couple times in Morgantown, West Virginia, and a couple guys contacted me, guys who I wasn't representing at trial, but who are serving their sentence, and asked if I could help them get released on COVID. Now, this was about March when COVID literally had just broken. Compassionate release has always been a vehicle available to federal criminal defendants, but it was very, very selectively used. Prior to COVID, you were going to see compassionate release used mostly in situations where the inmate was the caregiver to somebody who was terminally ill. That was sort of the compassionate release that the legislature had in mind. The idea behind that was that the courts would exercise compassion in releasing the inmate who could then take care of the loved one who was terminally ill. So COVID broke and we started using compassionate release. If you read the letter of the law, there's nothing prohibiting us from using compassionate release in circumstances in which the inmate himself is actually in a volatile situation, a delicate health situation that would merit compassion. So what we did in the defense bar is we pieced together an argument where we were applying this pre-COVID legislation known as compassionate release to COVID-related cases. And I mean, honestly, I just got lucky in the beginning. I had a couple white-collar clients who had no violent history and sort of hit what I call the COVID trifecta. The COVID trifecta is high blood pressure, diabetes, and or obesity. And these are what the CDC has been telling us makes you particularly vulnerable to COVID-19. So you take a vulnerable person to COVID-19 and you put them in a custodial setting where there's no hand sanitizer, there's no ability to wash their hands every day, and there's no real opportunity for social distancing. You take those two and you make an argument that this highly vulnerable individual is really in a powder keg and needs to get out. So this is what I started doing. I started applying for compassionate release. I have to tell you, I was extremely successful on my nonviolent clients, my clients who had, as I said, a white collar history or they had committed economic crimes. I ran into stumbling blocks on my violent clients, my clients with a violent background or numerous criminal convictions. And my judges, across the board were took a little more of a hard line when my client had a hardened criminal history and I was arguing for his release. So enter John Bass into the equation and you get a federal judge to overlook that criminal history and release him on COVID grounds. It's really, from the criminal defense attorney would say that's a home run, because the idea behind compassionate release is you have to evaluate the person who's in front of you, not the person you sentenced 22 years ago.
Yeah, let's be clear real quick. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I want to be clear to the listeners. Arthur Tarnow, the U.S. District Judge that let John Breadman Bass out, was the same judge that sentenced Breadman Bass back in 2003 to the double murder life in prison without parole. So just playing on what you said, it's the trial judge that is making a evaluation now almost 20 years later that, you know, if the person that he sentenced in 2003 or presided over his trial in 2002, what is that person now in 2021? And I know in Arthur Tarnow's opinion, he said that Mr. Bass had undergone a transformative rehabilitation and had gotten his GED and was a life coach and had done a lot of stuff to impress his trial judge that led that trial judge to overlook the violent behavior and release him. Sorry, continue.
Right, and that's an important point to make, Scott, because what he said in his opinion is, look, this case started 22 years ago, and in the course of 22 years, there's been multiple federal prosecutors and multiple criminal defense attorneys on the case. Me, Arthur Tarnow, has been the only consistent person who has seen this individual and this case from beginning to end. And in that regard, I have to say it was a very compelling point. I mean, this is the judge who sentenced him to two life sentences and denied his 2255s. He had filed appeals once he was convicted. And this is the same judge who said, no, thank you. You're not getting your conviction overturned. Now we are 22 years later. In this pandemic, Bass has the trifecta, I think it's diabetes, hypertension and obesity.
Yeah, he's 325 pounds.
Right. So he's got, I think the CDC tells us that if you have a BMI of, I don't know, something like 40, you're at risk. Or so he clearly falls in that category. And the court, I think, quite eloquently and analytically went through the factors, the primary factor being in 22 years, this is an individual who availed himself of all the BOP programming that he could. He got his GED, he did the apprentice workshops, he did, you know, this class, that class, and the other class. And he did this believing he was serving a life sentence. And to me, that's very compelling. I mean, it's one thing to do the classes thinking you're going to get an early release, but here we've got a guy who literally never thought he'd see the front door, and he still did what he could to make himself a better person. Now, you know, whether it's a bunch of bullshit or not, I do not know. But the fact of the matter is he did the programming BOP puts out there for its inmates. And that's what the judge looked at. The judge looked at his record and said, I've got a guy here who has programmed for the last 22 years. I'm going to take a chance on him and I'm going to let him go. And, you know, I think I said the other day to somebody, either you believe in human redemption or you don't. And in this practice, I really don't know what I believe in, but Judge Tarnow has consistently believed in second chances. So this opinion is consistent with his jurisprudence.
Can we talk about this from a macro perspective for a moment? Can we talk about some data in terms of how many, the situation in prison right now? I mean, how many people are testing positive for
corona? It's a petri dish.
Yeah, I mean, do we have any like raw data that we can go on to say, okay, this is how many prisoners are infected, and this is why this is an urgent situation that we take these cases into consideration? Can you speak to that, like at the macro level?
Yeah, what I can tell you is that BOP was never able to get a grip on this, and it's no fault on BOP's. I mean, we know now that we need to be socially distant and we need to exercise extra zealous hygiene in order to not catch this thing. And BOP, because of the fact that it's in a custodial setting, hasn't been able to get a grip on this. That's why they themselves started releasing prisoners. That's kind of an important point too. I mean, before you even hit the door of the courthouse, it is a requirement that you go through BOP's protocol and ask for release. I think you had mentioned Scott.
Terry Flannery.
Yes, it was Terry Flannery. Yeah, and I looked him up because I didn't remember seeing an opinion come down on that. And that was a BOP release. That never hit the courtroom. So BOP, in recognition that this is really something out of its control, has its own protocol for releasing people. Now, I can tell you that FCI McKean, which is where Bass was one of the like top three or four FCI facilities where there was outbreaks.
What state was that again?
That's in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's in Pennsylvania. And that's where you're going to see Detroit guys go who have committed a violent crime and are sentenced to something higher than 10 years. I mean, there's different grades in Detroit, as Scott, I know, I'm sure you know. So that's FCI McKean is one of the common places Detroit guys go who have a violent history.
And Terry Flannery was in Ashland in Kentucky. And this is kind of playing on some of the nuance that you're speaking of. Now, Terry Flannery, also known as Southwest T, one of the co-founders or the boss of the Black Mafia family, the most notorious, iconic urban crime organization in American history, started here in Detroit, and then by the late 90s, early 2000s, had expanded to something like 23 or 24 different states. Just an incredibly expansive organization with a lot of reach and a lot of notoriety. But Terry Flannery was not a violent offender. He was a nonviolent offender. He was merely convicted of running a continuing criminal enterprise, which was his narcotics trafficking organization, but there was no counts of violence on his case.
Okay.
So him and his brother, Demetrius Big Meech Flannery, the more infamous of the two brothers, both took 30-year pleas in 2007. Their out date was supposed to be 2032. Terry Flannery got a sentence reduction in, I believe, at the end of 19 or mid-19, where his sentence was reduced to where he was supposed to come out in 2026. And then fast forward 6 months, pandemic hits. 2 months into the pandemic, as Angelie mentioned, BOP lets Terry out of his prison cell in Ashland, Kentucky, and allows him to come back to Detroit to serve the remainder of his sentence on home confinement.
Okay, and so that makes sense, because BOP's internal protocol is to evaluate the conviction. They're not going to get in underlying crimes or, you know, who your co-defendants are. Right. They're just looking at the actual conviction. And they're looking at what you've done in prison. They assign a pattern score to you, so they probably gave him a low pattern score. I'm guessing, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing he also availed himself of programming, BOP programming. Again, I don't know if the BOP programming is bullshit or not, but if they're doing it, they should get credit for it, because I know plenty of inmates who go to prison and they don't do anything except watch TV. Yeah. So, you know, the system is working a little bit if you're taking advantage of what BOP has to offer and you're getting credit to it for it.
So I have some, I looked this up, the this is from the Marshall Project, just for some context for people. So as of February 2nd, over 370,000 inmates have tested positive for coronavirus. And in Pennsylvania specifically, which is where Bass was sentenced, it's 9,500 inmates have been diagnosed, and that's comes out to 2,000 per every 10,000 prisoners. So I just to, if someone is out there thinking, well, you know, why should we give a shit? Like, fuck these guys. Like, just there's some context of, like, this just seems like a public health crisis, especially in prison, not just everywhere else.
As Angelie
in the world
mentioned, I mean, right, there are inherent factors in running a correctional facility that are diametrically opposed to taking COVID precautions.
Right.
I mean, you can't socially distance.
Right.
And hygiene becomes an issue. And a lot of these guys, you know, only get to shower once every couple of days.
And it's group showers.
Right.
I mean, they're not literally grouped together, but it's not, you know, everybody's on top of each other, brushing their teeth, taking their shower, their dinners. There's no hand sanitizer. There's no alcohol-based hand sanitizer available, period. So you're stuck with washing your hands. How often can you get to the restroom to wash your hands when you're stuck in a petri dish with 500 guys? I shouldn't be laughing. I mean, it's not funny, but it's fun. It's almost like the worst possible environment to avoid COVID.
So just over 2,300 deaths, according to the Marshall Project, from in prison.
So how do you reconcile the fact that when we're talking about the Flannery brothers, who are without question probably the two most notorious federal felons in terms of the American drug game, it doesn't get any bigger than Black Mafia Family and Terry and Demetrius Flannery, who are, as I mentioned, born and bred Southwest Detroiters who both left the state in the 90s and expanded their drug operation around the country. But the home base, the epicenter of Black Mafia Family, always existed in Detroit. How do you reconcile the fact that, you know, BOP didn't seem to have an issue letting Terry out early, but Demetrius Flannery right now, who, again, was the more infamous of the two, but they were both convicted of the same exact, case, both nonviolent offenders, and Demetrius is hitting roadblock after roadblock to even get kind of consideration to be released to home confinement.
Well, you see the difference, though, right? The one, Terry went through BOP and hit a home run.
Mm-hmm.
And Demetrius, in order to get to the courts, you have to go through BOP, so I'm guessing.
So he went through BOP, couldn't get out through the warden at his prison in Oregon, Sheridan, Oregon.
And is now
in front of David. It was in front of David Lawson.
Right, perfect. Okay, so David Lawson is going to do the same thing that Arthur Tarnow did. He's going to look at the person in front of him, not the person he sentenced. How long ago did he get sentenced?
They got sentenced they copped the plea in 07. I believe their sentencing was in 08.
Okay.
But they'd been locked up since 05.
Right. So I'm guessing, I didn't get a chance to pull the opinion, but I'm guessing there's less tangible.
Well, see, Terry fits what you said, the trifecta. Terry is a large man who does have diabetes. He's over 300 pounds. Demetrius, although they're brothers, they're twin brothers, but, or excuse me, they're not twin brothers. They're, although they're brothers, they don't have the same body type. Demetrius was slimmer and...
And they're young guys too, aren't they?
I think Demetrius 52 and Terry's 50.
Okay, so not, So as far as COVID's concerned, I mean, we know now from the literature that you're really more at risk when you're like 65, 70, 75, that. So he didn't have age working for him. I don't really know what his health issues were, but...
He claimed that he had, you know, the COVID concerns. He had a doctor's notes from Henry Ford saying that he met the same criteria that his brother did, but Judge Lawson rejected it.
Okay, so there's a couple of things going on. First of all, do you meet the medical criteria? Now, in Bass's case, the government conceded he met the medical criteria. So the analysis is, do you meet the medical criteria? And if you do... Well, let me look at the sentencing factors. The most pivotal sentencing factor here is, are you safe? Are you going to go out and commit another crime, or can I feel good about myself letting you out? What have you done in prison in the last 10 to 15 years to show me that you will not recidivize, that show me that you have been rehabilitated? I didn't get a chance to pull the opinion, so I don't know what, if anything, he did. But that's the analysis the judges are undertaking. What's interesting here is that in Bass's case, Bass's, let's call it rehabilitative efforts, whether you believe it or not, Bass's rehabilitative efforts really outshined his terrible, horrible, ugly crime.
Well, to the judge it did.
Right. And I think what's significant is he did that programming never expecting to see the front door. And I think Judge Charno even mentioned that. Here's a guy who's basically been sentenced to death, though it's not death, it's two life sentences. But what's he doing? How's he spending his time? Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention about Bass is the judge did comment on his really long-term cooperation with the government on other homicides. It seemed like that was a big deal to the judge. A lot of times you know, when somebody's cooperating, either they're doing it to save their own skin or they're doing it because they have reformed and they have seen the error of their ways. And Judge Tarnow in this situation chose to believe that the cooperation was connected to the rehabilitation.
How much of a role do you think infamy plays in this decision? Because when we're talking about Bass, when we're talking about the Flannerys, you're talking about people who have reputations that follow them. I mean, Bass himself might not be a household name for people that follow the news in Detroit. But if you look a little deeper into the Bass story, all of a sudden you start coming up with the YBI connection. And Young Boys Incorporated, they ran the drug game in Detroit in the late 70s and the early 80s. Their boss was Milton Butch Jones, the self-proclaimed Henry Ford of heroin. And when he got out of his prison sentence on the YBI case, he joined John Bass and his brother, Pat Webb, in the dog pound. So I've actually seen some reporting that is incorrect in saying that John Bass was a leader of YBI. But just having the letters YBI attached to your name, especially in Detroit, is going to give you a certain level of infamy. And then with the Flannerys, I think the biggest worry, in my humble opinion, you know, Demetrius Flannery, again, is not your average prisoner. He is someone that even from a prison cell sways opinion. I mean, he influences literally millions of people. I read a stat in one of his court filings recently where the prosecutor said that in the last, I think it was either 5 years or 10 years, Demetrius Flannery's name has been shouted out on 175 hip-hop songs that have made the Billboard Top 50. 175 times in the last 5 years. I mean, he is like Black Jesus Christ to a lot of people. And I don't...
How did this happen?
It's just kind of the melding of hip hop and crime and culture.
What is that? Is that the judge's position?
Yeah.
I mean, why is that relevant? I mean,
I'm asking her. Does she think it plays a role?
You're asking me, does their reputation precede them when it comes to the decision?
Right.
Yeah.
I have to say no, because I got to tell you guys, I have incredibly compelling clients sitting in prison right now who have no reputation for anything. You guys wouldn't know them from, you know, anybody else on the street. And I'm still having trouble getting them out. So I can't believe that the reputation is swaying one way or another. I mean, Scott, you know, I have a doctor who was sentenced to 328 years in prison. He's at USP Terre Haute, which is where John Bass started out. I don't remember if his first name's John. Where Mr. Bass started out.
It's John Bass, the bread man, yeah.
They were incarcerated together at USP Terre Haute. Bass worked his way down to FCI McKean, which is great. My client, because he was sentenced to 328 years, he can't work himself down. I mean, he's essentially sentenced to life at USP Terre Haute. First-time offender, not arguing about his guilt or innocence. I mean, he prescribed narcotics that he shouldn't have prescribed. He was 64 at the time. Now he's 78. I've got a petition pending for him for his compassionate release. I have to believe that the reputation is not going to sway the court. I have to believe that the court's going to go on, is this person at risk, which my client happens to be, and has this person rehabilitated themselves?
Can you speak to your client you're talking about? What can you give us more details about what do you mean he was prescribing things that he wasn't supposed to? Are we talking about painkillers or?
Yeah, so here's the deal. He's a doctor. He ran a medical clinic in Flint. And the feds must have got wind of some kind of, let's call it, suspicious activity. So they sent in three undercover agents to basically get scripts from him. And so what I mean by that is, you know, they went in, said, this is my ailment, my back hurts, my knee hurts, whatever. My client didn't perform the medical examination that was necessary and gave them the script. This happened, I want to say it happened three times with three undercover agents. So nine scripts. He was charged with unlawfully prescribing nine scripts. And he was convicted. And I'm not, again, here to argue his guilt or innocence. But he's also been in prison for 16 years in a maximum security prison.
So 300 for nine prescriptions. I mean, this is insane. I'm not saying he should have either, but 300. I mean, 300 years for someone who's writing. I mean, that boggles the mind.
So since you're asking, I'm gonna explain it. What ended up happening was every script generated its own charge. So even though the scripts were going to the same agents, every script generated its own charge. And what would normally happen is if you're convicted, you're going to get sentenced, let's say 20-year sentence, everything is going to run concurrent. It's 20 years for your whole crime. Here, the judge maxed out the client. In other words, he sentenced him to 20 years, which is the stat max, on every script, totaling 328 years.
So let me ask you, were they able to connect the scripts to, so it's one thing if you're prescribing something to someone and you're not like checking the background of the patient, like to make sure that they have an MRI or something like that. But I mean, could they connect like the people, but it's another thing if you're writing prescriptions to like a member of BMF or something like, and you could demonstrate it's like a pill mill. I mean,
the biker gangs do that a lot.
Right. I mean, was there any evidence that there's like a nefarious, a reason for writing these prescriptions? Well,
he was in bed with some type of criminal organization.
Right. I mean, is that part of the case?
Oh God, no. My client worked alone. He wasn't working with any big organization. He worked alone. I fully believe he did it for the $45 he got in cash for each script. And he did it numerous times with undercover agents. Now, I didn't represent him at trial, so don't quote me on any of this. I came in during COVID. Some of my clients told me about a doctor who was sitting in a maximum security prison. serving a 328-year sentence. And I didn't believe it. I said, no way. This can't be true. So I researched it, found it to be true, and said, I got to do something because this is just outrageous.
I agree with you. So who ratted him out? Was that the DEA was sniffing around. I mean, they're hot to bust these kind of guys right now.
They're so hot to bust these guys. I've got a doctor in Milan pretrial. He has not gone to trial yet. He's also elderly. Got the COVID trifecta. He can't get out. The DEA is hot to trot right now on the doctors.
Yeah, and I think this is. I mean, this is relevant. I guess it I'm going off the rails a little bit here, but we're talking about Scott mentioned editorializing. I think this is becoming a human rights issue because there are people who have legitimate pain issues who need prescription and doctors are not prescribing it because they're afraid of the DEA. And it's because of this. It's because of they don't want to they write something wrong on the chart and then the DEA raids the place and say they're going to give you 20 years for writing a bad script. I mean, so there's people suffering out there who can't get their meds because the DEA is hot to bust these guys.
It's almost like you've got a bullseye. If you're a healthcare provider, you've got a bullseye on your back, so you better be careful. I don't even know how fun it is to be a doctor anymore. I mean, you know, 50% of my practice is healthcare fraud. And I'm telling you right now, these doctors are not enjoying their profession. It's like damned if you do, damned if you don't.
I know the FBI right now is putting a lot of attention and resources into healthcare fraud. I had some conversations with some current FBI agents back in the summer, and they were telling me that. And I think it's tied into when we're talking about the DEA and investigating the doctors that are maybe writing suspicious scripts. But it's such a complicated issue. I mean, you have an opioid crisis right now that is full-blown, and you've gone from a situation where the last time we had this type of heroin epidemic, and make no mistake about it, the pills are it's just synthetic heroin. You start popping pills and you get a habit, you're not that far away from jabbing a vein. And, you know, making this a little socio-academic, you know, the last time I feel like our country underwent this type of drug epidemic with heroin, it was in the 60s and 70s, and it was kind of reserved to black communities. And now it's in the suburbs, and it's in rich white communities.
I mean, if I can push back, because I'm a ferocious critic of the war on drugs, the so-called opioid epidemic right now, I mean, this is fentanyl. This is coming from China, and it's being processed by the Mexican cartels. It's not fucking 65-year-old doctors prescribing. Like, I mean, there's right. just like this myth that everyone's hooked on opioids because their doctor's prescribing it. That's not what's happening. This is underworld. This is underworld. It's cartels.
Gangland economy.
Yeah, right. It's coming from. So like the DEA to like emphasize and be hot to catch these doctors. And, you know, I'm not saying like the doctors, whatever, shouldn't be more careful. But I'm just saying like this notion that the doctors are the gangsters. That's not true. The gangsters are the gangsters here. That's where the pills are coming from. Fentanyl is coming from the cartels via China. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
No, you're right. It's almost like the DEA has shifted its focus from where the drugs are coming from to who's prescribing the drug. So that's a really excellent point, actually. What about the cartel? Why aren't we prosecuting those guys anymore? Why do you have the binoculars on the pain center? Why are you wiring up patients to go in to catch my doctors prescribing pills for me when I'm going in because my back hurts?
No, I agree. And I think I would argue I talk to people in the DEA and they profoundly disagree with me and I respect that. But I think it's because they're easier target. Who is it easier to go after? A 65-year-old?
Fish in a barrel.
compared
to going to El Chapo.
Right. Like it just makes sense, right? Who's easier target?
They're easier targets and they have deeper pockets because, you know, there's a whole component to these drug cases called asset forfeiture. And the DEA, I mean, and I work with the DEA, federal prosecutor, and I respect the job they do. But let us not forget, there's a little something called asset forfeiture, which means who's more lucrative for me? My cartel dealer, where I don't know where his assets are,
right?
Or my thing in his mansion. Well, I'm going for the doctor because I can prosecute him and take his money.
No, that's huge because the guys in Mexico, you'll never get your hands on that cash. You'll never find it. You'll never find him.
Never find them, let alone their money.
Right. No, that's a huge. I didn't even think about that. That's huge. It incentivizes the war on drugs.
As we're winding down here, I kind of want to pivot to a piece of legislation that I consider kind of a cousin to the conversation we're having right now with COVID compassionate releases. Again, not to editorialize too much. I don't want to go into my political affiliation, but I will say, in my opinion, the one very good thing that our former president Donald Trump did was sign the First Step Act in 2018, which is providing sentence reductions to nonviolent offenders. And by doing that, trying to shed some of the population in the prison system, which then leads to some of the issues we're having with COVID. So it's all a vicious circle.
No, that's right. It is related because the COVID problem is even more of a problem because of mass incarceration,
right,
which is connected to the war on drugs.
And I personally, and I have a law degree, I don't practice. I've studied the law. Obviously, I've written about crime for the last 15 years. I don't believe that 99% of the time a nonviolent offender should be doing more than 10 years in prison. I mean, yeah, there's the Bernie Madoffs of the world that probably deserve to do more than that, or the Kwame Kilpatricks that deserve to do more than that.
We didn't even play into Kwame.
But Kwame was a pardon or a commutation. It wasn't related to COVID.
By the way, were you part of that prosecution team? Were you part of the team that went after Kwame, the prosecutors?
No, I was in the office at that time, but no, I wasn't part of the team.
Okay.
But with the First Step Act, there's been a couple guys that I've been in contact with while they were locked up, and they were able to use the First Step Act to get sentence reductions, and they've both been released in the last 5-6 months. And they're guys that went down on drug continuing criminal enterprise cases, but there was no allegations of violence, and they both were serving what amounted to life sentences, had tried to go through the pardon process, both with Biden, through the pardon process, both with Trump and Obama. But they were able to get their sentence reduced in the last 6 months. I'm sure COVID might have played a role in it as well. Daryl Chambers, who was the Kronk boxing drug kingpin, who came up through the Kronk gym with Tommy Hearns and Emmanuel Stewart. He was busted in 1993 or 4. And then Felix the Cat Walls, who went down in a case around the same time in the mid-90s, who... again, nonviolent offender, that they both were able to receive sentence reductions. I know in Chicago, there have been a number of gangster disciple leaders that were looking at life sentences or you know, 50-year-plus sentences. I think there are three pretty prominent gangster disciples that have come home in the last year on sentence reductions from the First Step Act. So I guess, Angeli, just what's your opinion on the First Step Act and the kind of ripple effect something like that could have?
Yeah, I definitely have to give Trump props on that because I have, I can tell you in quite tangible ways that I have several clients who benefited from the First Step Act. A big deal for them was the good time credits. I am not sure if I have my math right, but I think prior to the First Step Act, my guys were getting 53 days of good time credit a year, and that President Trump increased that amount. So I think it went up to 57 days a year, which, you know, you wouldn't think is a big deal. But when you're looking at 5 or 8 or 10 year sentences, all those days accrue. So I had guys who, you know, got home even just a few months early, which is a lifetime when you're in prison. So I have to give him credit for that. I wish he didn't. He did this all because Jared Kushner got involved
for his old man.
Yeah, right. And Kanye West was campaigning pretty hard for this, and his wife Kim Kardashian is doing a lot of stuff for lifers and trying to get them out.
So Jared's dad went to prison, then he got into the Step Act and all this other stuff, and then Trump gave him a pardon.
Yeah.
So that was a bummer.
I agree. We could do
a whole episode on Kwame's pardon or commutation, and it just makes me sick. And it has nothing to do with race and has nothing to do with it's black and white. It's what's and not black and white in terms of race. It's good versus evil. And if Kwame Kilpatrick would have done 20 years of a 28-year sentence, I would feel comfortable letting him out early. But for someone that's done not even a quarter of the sentence, has done 7 years, has not shown one iota of contrition, constantly wants to try to play the race card, constantly wants to paint himself as the victim, and this man raped our city for 6 years, 7 years, and pushed us back. God knows how far we had to go back on the board in order to go forward to where we are right now. And thank God the city
of Detroit. Yeah, but Duggan applauded it.
I know.
So there's a lot of the curious things going on.
And I worked with some of Kwame's people in the Crime Town podcast that I was involved in 2 years ago with podcasters in New York. And we gave him this opportunity to come on the podcast. And I think he had three episodes and gave him something like 3 hours to talk. And, you know, all 3 hours was just him saying what a victim he was. And I'm like, why don't you use these 3 hours to try to make amends, to try to take some ownership of what you did. Instead, he says the only thing he did wrong was lie under oath about his affair.
He doesn't seem like he's wired that way. But can you mention some of the other, before we wrap up, some of the other prominent underworld figures that are using specifically the COVID compassionate release? You mentioned some earlier, Flannery, but there's a few others that are interesting.
In Detroit,
Leonard Moore, you gave me Leonard
Moore. So Leonard Big Daddy Moore. Probably the most powerful outlaw biker in the state of Michigan, the leader of the Highwaymen, which is the biggest outlaw motorcycle gang in the state, numbers-wise. He was convicted in a pretty sprawling racketeering case back in 2009, I believe.
But he had that COVID trifecta. I looked him up. Yeah. He had high blood pressure, diabetes, lung disease, and he's 72. So there you go.
But he got out like 16 years early. Street Lord Juan, DeJuan Wren, a.k.a. Street Lord Juan, got out, I think, 5 years early. He was a rapper slash drug dealer who was tied into the Blade Icewood crew of the early 2000s, the Cheddar Boys and all those guys. So those were two in addition to the Flannerys. But then, you know, Daryl Chambers, Felix Walls, I mentioned them on the First Step Act. I think that the Puritan Avenue Boys, the PA Boys, which is another pretty big West Side crime group, Reggie Dude Danzy and Damone Slim Brantley, who were the leaders of that crew, have been in prison for about 17 years. And they both, kind of what Angeli was saying, they didn't get huge sentence reductions, but I think they both walked out like 4 or 5 months early.
Okay.
Based on COVID concerns, but they were kind of trending towards coming out early anyway, but they got out earlier than they anticipated.
And any of were there some Italian guys too that were trying
Was not in Detroit. There were some Italian guys or mafia figures in Detroit that have died from COVID.
Right.
Toto Ruggiero, right. Eddie Karam, Steady Eddie Karam. I know in Chicago, Mario Rainoni got out early. He was a mob enforcer.
For compassionate release
on compassionately related to COVID, and there's been a handful of New York mob guys that have gotten out.
I thought some of the cartel guys that are
Lot of the cartel guys have kind of what Angeli was saying. A lot of the cartel guys have made have filed through their attorneys for compassionate release,
right.
And these are guys that these were like contemporaries of Pablo and El Chapo,
right.
Guys that were running either the Medellin cartel or the Cali cartel, and they haven't been successful in those endeavors.
Yeah, I don't see that happening.
Although anything's possible. I mean, hence John Bass getting out.
Yes,
who could have seen that coming?
No, that's a good point.
No, that's why it got national headlines. That's why I was reading about it in the New York Post yesterday.
Right.
Well, we want to thank Angeli Prasad for coming on. I'm sorry if I was butchering your name. You are an outstanding advocate and have an amazing reputation. And we are just in debt to you for coming on and sharing your knowledge. And
let's go with Kwame next time.
Yes,
for sure. You have to come back on.
And
for
is there anything you want to get out there to plug or any other stuff you want people to know about you or any cases that you're involved in right now?
Well, I'm Like I said, I was a federal prosecutor for many years. I now do federal criminal defense. I did about, 50% of my caseload last year was compassionate release. I've got a lot of guys who are still incarcerated. I'm trying to get out, but my heart's with my doctor that I mentioned. It's Dr. Mukherjee. It was Eastern District of Michigan case. He's sentenced to 328 years in U.S. v. Terre Haute. That petition is pending. I do not have a decision back yet. So I just, I'm keeping my fingers crossed for him.
Yeah, that's a compelling case. I appreciate you coming on, but also bringing that to our attention. And thanks again for coming on. You're always welcome on the Original Gangsters podcast. Good luck with that. And to everyone out there listening, remember to check out some of our other episodes. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and we'll see you next time on the Original Gangsters podcast. Thanks again.
Okay, see you guys. Bye.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry to keep you from your mom. Have a great birthday dinner.
We will.
We will be in touch, and if you're game, we'd love to have you back on.
I love to do it. I do WXYZ a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is perfect.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for the audience for consuming this episode. This is just one subject of a wide array of Original Gangsters content that we want to bring you, whether we're talking about policy issues like we've talked about in these last couple episodes, or we're talking about great historical stories, or we're talking about breaking news, or if we're talking about, we're always trying to look for that nexus between pop culture and crime. That's what we're going to be giving you here on the OG. We hope you like it, and we're going to keep bringing it to you. I'm Scott Bernstein, Jimmy Bucciolato. Thanks to Wade Fink. Thanks to our producer, WJR, The Great Voice Podcast Network. Look for that, startupnation.com. We are in your debt, and we love being part of the family here. Scott Bernstein, JB, we're out. We'll see you next time on an Original Gangsters podcast.